like to welcome everyone to yet another episode of Two Men in a Bible Fighting the Cosmic Battle. My name is Jamie Sanchez, and again, I'm joined by Pastor Bob Brandon. How are you, Bobo?
I'm good, and I'm better always when I get to see your smiling face. You know, we often do these in the evening, and we've had long days and so on, particularly you nowadays, but these times always recharge my battery.
Oh, they do mine, too. They give me some, you know, they, as you just put it, they recharge my battery for sure, and it really pumps, I don't know how to describe it, pumps my heart up for the week, you know.
Yeah,
it really,
that's right.
It gets that.
Yeah,
that
there really is strength in the word of the Lord.
Mm-hmm. I would absolutely agree, and you know, I was sharing with you a little bit, I've been able to talk with some of the people that I've encountered over the past week, and being able to talk to them about the Word of God is just, it's so great. You know, sometimes you get in the company of someone who really doesn't want to hear the truth.
Yeah.
And they're usually the ones that you don't talk religion or politics with.
Yeah.
So really something unsubstantive.
That's right.
But we're gonna cover some ground tonight, huh?
Well, we're going to see. We're going to start. I usually, you know, I'm prepared to do the whole thing, but then you bog me down with a bunch of questions. But we'll see how far we can get tonight. Should we just dive in?
Let's do it.
We're in Genesis chapter 36. So I'm going to ask you some questions, Jamie, when we get done reading this chapter. And I'm going to do my usual on pronunciation.
Do you want the golf clap?
Yeah, well... Yeah, I'm going to go, you know, fast and with confidence, because no one really knows how to pronounce this stuff. Genesis 36. Now these are the records of the generations of Esau, that is, Edom. Esau took his wives from the daughters of Canaan, Ada, the daughter of Elon the Hittite, and Oholibamah, the daughter of Anah, and the granddaughter of Zibeon the Hivite. Also Basemath, Ishmael's daughter, the sister of Nebaioth. Ada bore Eliphaz to Esau, and Basemath bore Reuel, and Oholibamah bore Jush, and Jalam, and Korah. These are the sons of Esau, who were born to him in the land of Canaan. Then Esau took his wives and his sons and his daughters, and all his household, and his livestock, and all his cattle, and all his goods, which he had acquired in the land of Canaan, excuse me, and went to another land away from his brother Jacob, for their property had become too great for them to live together. And the land where they sojourned could not sustain them because of all their livestock. So Esau lived in the hill country of Seir. Esau is Edom. These, then, are the records of the generations of Esau, the father of the Edomites in the hill country of Seir. These are the names of Esau's sons: Eliphaz, the son of Esau's wife, Ada; Reuel, the son of Esau's wife, Basemath. The sons of Eliphaz were Teman and Omar, Zepho and Gatam and Kenaz. Timnah was a concubine of Esau's son Eliphaz, and she bore Amalek to Eliphaz. These are the sons of Esau's wife, Ada. These are the sons of Reuel, Nahath, and Zerah, and Shammah, and Mizah. These are the sons of Esau's wife, Basemath. These are the sons of Esau's wife, Oholibamah, the daughter of Anah, and the granddaughter of Zibeon. She bore to Esau Jeush, and Jalam, and Korah. These are the chiefs of the sons of Esau, the sons of Eliphaz, the firstborn of Esau, our chief Teman, chief Omar, chief Zepho, chief Kenaz, chief Korah, chief Gatam, chief Amalek. These are the chiefs descended from Eliphaz in the land of Edom. These are the sons of Ada. These are the sons of Reuel, Esau's son, chief Nahath, chief Zerah, chief Shammah, chief Mizah. These are the chiefs descended from Reuel in the land of Edom. These are the sons of Esau's wife, Basemath. These are the sons of Esau's wife, Oholibamah, Chief Jeush, Chief Jalam, Chief Korah. These are the chiefs descended from Esau's wife, Oholibamah, the daughter of Anah. These are the sons of Esau, that is, Edom. These are their chiefs. These are the sons of Seir, the Horite, the inhabitants of the land, Lotan, and Shobal, and Zibeon, and Anah, and Dishan, and Ezer, and Dishan. These are the chiefs descended from the Horites, the sons of Seir, in the land of Edom. The sons of Lotan were Hori and Hemam, and Lotan's sister was Timnah. These are the sons of Shobal, Alvan, Manahath, and Ebal, Shepho and Onam. These are the sons of Zibeon, Aah, and Anah. He's the Anah who found the hot springs in the wilderness when he was pasturing the donkeys of his father Zibeon. These are the children of Anah, Dishan, and Oholibamah, the daughter of Anah. These are the sons of Dishan, Hemdan, Eshban, and Ithran, and Keran. These are the sons of Ezer, Bilhan, and Zaavan, and Akan. These are the sons of Dishan, Uz, and Aran. These are the chiefs descended from the Horites, Chief Lotan, Chief Shobal, Chief Zibeon, Chief Anah, Chief Dishan, Chief Ezer, Chief Dishan. These are the chiefs descended from the Horites, according to the various chiefs in the land of Seir. Now these are the kings who reigned in the land of Edom, before any king reigned over the sons of Israel. Bela, the son of Beor, reigned in Edom, and the name of his city was Dinhabah. Then Bela died, and Jobab, the son of Zerah of Bozrah, became king in his place. Then Jobab died, and Husham of the land of Timnites became king in his place. Then Husham died, and Hadad, the son of Bedad, who defeated Midian in the field of Moab, became king in his place. And the name of his city was Avith. Then Hadad died, and Samla of Masrekah became king in his place. Then Samla died, and Shaul of Rehoboth on the Euphrates River became king in his place. Then Shaul died, and Baal-Hanan, the son of Achbor, became king in his place. Then Baal-Hanan, the son of Achbor, died, and Hadar became king in his place, and the name of his city was Pau, and his wife's name was Mehetabel, the daughter of Matred, daughter of Mezahab. Now these are the names of the chiefs descended from Esau, according to their families and their localities, by their names: Chief Timnah, Chief Alva, Chief Jeheth, Chief Oholibamah, Chief Elah, Chief Pinan, Chief Kenaz, Chief Teman, Chief Mibzar, Chief Magdiel, Chief Iram. These are the chiefs of Edom, that is, Esau, the father of the Edomites, according to their habitations in the land of their possession. Man, I've got to say, yeah, first off, that is actually the hardest chapter I've ever read out loud.
I bet. I can't even imagine trying
those
that.
Those are some difficult names. You know, it's interesting, though, part of what was going through my mind as I was reading it was I was sort of smiling to myself because, as we often say, even about the New Testament, you know, originally when this was written, the people heard it. You know, very few people would have had copies of the scriptures, particularly, you know, as Moses wrote this. So they would have been not sitting around a campfire like a Cub Scout sort of thing, but, you know, during the evening, it would be read to them. Perhaps during the day, the priest would read it to the Levites. But that's how they would have heard that, just the rhythm of it somehow, you
right.
know, those names. So what do you got as we go over a chapter like that? You know, I always picture our vision is for the person at home who wants to quietly sit in their own room and read the scriptures, beginning with Genesis, and going straight through the book and wishing they had some kind of input to guide
right.
them through that. And so this is one of those chapters that, you know, when you're on your own, you kind of read that, you just sort of skim it, which I don't really think there's disrespect to the Lord in doing that. I mean, we're trying to get through the scriptures, but, you know, you kind of go, okay. And then you keep reading, because, I mean, it has, you know, what's up?
Well, and as we've talked before, I hit a chapter like this, and it's almost like deer in the headlights. But luckily, you've trained me, you know, a little better than that.
All right.
And so, as I was reading through this, I know that I brought up the question before of, why is this in here? Why do we need it?
That's the question you should ask.
And, you know, because Esau is not Jacob, so...
No, but he's part of that family, but
right.
He's not Jacob.
And so, then I remembered what you shared with me many podcasts ago, which is the two stories that are intertwined, that are being unveiled here.
Yeah.
And the seed of the serpent and the seed of the woman.
Okay.
Is that where we're at here?
All right. Now, that's a great, you know, here came the pitch, and you eyballed that thing, and you swung, and whoosh, but you
swing
swung.
Missed.
You got the bat off your shoulder. This really isn't the seed of the serpent, but that's a great, you're right in, you know, pursuing that way. In this case, more what's going on is something that I think we're going to be able to talk about a little bit in depth, oddly enough, even out of this a chapter like this. What Moses is accomplishing in this chapter is a couple things. You remember, he's writing this in the neighborhood of 1450 BC to a people group who are becoming a nation, coming out of captivity in Egypt, and Moses is telling them the story of the whole universe, but they have a central role to play. He's telling them who they are in the story. They're key players. They're the descendants of Abraham. They're in the nation of Israel. But at this point, Jacob, one of their patriarchs, the third, after Abraham, Isaac, then Jacob, is contrasted with Esau. Okay, remember this whole birthright thing, and Jacob got all the blessing. You know, and Isaac said, you know, I don't have any blessing left over for you, except you'll throw off the yoke of your brother, right? And you'll live, you know, in this area and become a nation. They are, right? I mean, this, what strikes you in this chapter is how large that group becomes. Remember a couple chapters ago when Jacob has been over trying to get his family going.
Right.
And Esau's back home, you know, with the Canaanites, and when Jacob comes to meet him, there's 400 men with Esau. Just men. In what, 20 years' time, he's already got 400 guys attached to him as a military group.
Right.
Esau became a huge force. These are the Edomites. It says that three or four times in this chapter. These are the Edomites. Now think, you're Israel coming out of Egypt. You're going to run into these guys. Right? These are your relatives. Right? This is a whole entire nation that came out of Esau. And they're powerful. It says they've got kings. You know, Moses is listing all their kings. He's making these comments like before there was ever a king in Israel. These guys had kings.
I did notice that.
Okay, so in other words, I want you to listen to this. This one's written out. I just want to read it carefully. There are really two main points in this chapter. First, Moses wants to contrast Jacob and Esau. Esau, who is Edom, is hugely successful. Jacob is much smaller at this point. Jacob's pretty large, but not compared to his brother Esau. So Jacob is much smaller at this point on the success scale. Secular greatness, in general, grows up far more rapidly than spiritual greatness. Right? Jacob's the spiritual seed, and he's getting bigger, but he's nowhere near the size and success of Esau. Esau's the secular success. That happens quickly. Spiritual growth, the promised spiritual blessing, that's what Jacob got, right? Out of the birthright. Everything ultimately is going to happen through him.
Right.
Right? In his seed. The promised spiritual blessing demands patience. Patience in faith, and emphasizes that waiting while others prosper is a test of faithfulness and perseverance. Wisdom literature in the Bible makes that same evaluation. You know, Proverbs, Psalms, stuff like that. In other words, the get-rich-quick guys.
Mm-hmm.
That's usually not the way of the Lord. In fact, hardly ever. I'd go so far as to say hardly ever. Spiritual growth is a slow, steady process.
And so that's what Moses is saying to the Israelites
at that time? He is saying, here's your brothers. Okay? Because there's more to it. I'm going to go on in a minute. But, so here's your brothers. Look how quick these guys expanded. We're the spiritual seed. They're the secular seed.
Hmm.
That's what he's saying.
Okay.
And you don't really want to, you know, to apply this to today. We see this, you know, there's a few of us in our circles that we run with it. We constantly have this kind of conversation. But today, there's massive pressure on the church in the West, you know, in America,
mm-hmm.
and Western Europe and so on, to adopt the formulas of secular society and apply them to the church. We elect elders based on how successful they were in the world. You know, oh, this guy started his great company, he became a millionaire, so he must be good at spiritual stuff. That's how we reason. And that is not the way the Lord reasons. Spiritual growth is typically much slower than secular growth. And there's no speeding it up. There are no shortcuts to it.
Right.
There is no way for Sophia to become 11 years old rather than 10 than to go through each day and get to 11. She can't wake up tomorrow and be 11.
That's very well put. I can totally,
you know, spiritually, same thing. You've got to grow. You can't. There are no shortcuts to that. It takes a long time of constant work. And looking around and watching the secular world explode in success, you go, man, I'm still here, you know, plugging along. That's right. We're growing a whole different. It's like you're a whole different. If you could imagine a vegetable garden, you're a whole different vegetable. You know, those weeds pop up, mushrooms pop up overnight, literally. Not the kind of Christian growth that we are. That takes a long time.
No, that makes total sense. I would have never, sitting there at home on my own reading this chapter, wouldn't have even got that far.
Well, but that's the contrast, right? Because it's kind of overwhelming. And it's a repetition of all these kings that came out of Esau and all these descendants and how big he got and how quickly.
And I noticed the kings, you know, it wasn't the son of the guy before him that became the king next time. It's, you know, it's another, you know, a king.
Well, that's right.
From another area,
yeah,
became
that's
king.
Right. That's right.
And the chiefs, what was that? Well, I won't go there yet.
All right. So here's the second point out of that chapter. The second point is that Edom becomes a micro picture of a relationship with Israel that typifies Israel's relationship with the other nations.
Now, what do you mean by that?
When you read the prophet Obadiah, he's talking about Edom. You know, the message is, this is your brother. You guys need to relate to each other in that way. Let me finish out the thought. The possession of Edom, like who's going to control Edom, is a mark of strength and the victorious reign of the star that would arise from Jacob in Numbers chapter 24. Actually, all this chapter that we just read, Israel's going to rule that. Jacob is ultimately going to rule all that, but it's going to be much further down the line. It's going to be the spiritual rule of all that. So in the New Testament, James, for instance, in the book of Acts, in Acts chapter 15, verse 17, quotes a passage about the remnant of Edom from the book of Amos and applies it to his application is that represents all of mankind. When you see Edom coming into the fold of Israel, that's a picture of all mankind. Think of it, Jamie, as we often say, we're tracing things back to Abraham, but actually God in the Bible traces everything back to Adam.
Right.
There is a brotherhood of man. Ultimately, we are all related. And Edom's relationship with Israel is the picture of the rest of the world's relationship with Israel. That's the way the Bible plays this out over time. Edom comes up in the New Testament.
Well, and that was one of my questions is who are the Edomites?
That's Esau.
Yeah.
That's Esau. It says three times in this chapter, Esau, who is Edom.
And do they continue to grow and prosper? And
they do, and Israel has trouble with them. You know, there's conflict, there's brotherly conflict between these guys and so on. But that's right, they're always the picture, like when you read the book of Obadiah, that Amos mentions them, like we referred to earlier, they're the picture of the rest of the world's relationship to Israel as well.
Hmm.
So it's a very interesting stuff. It's a chapter that you would just kind of read on your own and go, okay, man, bunch of names, you know, doesn't have anything to do with me. It has to do with a much bigger picture, you know, and so it trains us to look for the kind of themes that are important. Remember our thesis that you can't really healthily, accurately apply the words of God to your life until you know what they meant to their original audience.
Right.
Then you can successfully apply it to yourself. But you can't just rip stuff out of the Bible. And as we've mentioned already, if you're the nation of Israel and you're coming out of Egypt in 1450 BC, you're going to run into the Edomites. These are relatives of yours.
Close relatives.
Yeah.
In a, you know, a sense.
Right.
Huh.
That's right.
So then the two stories that, you know, it's obvious that are intertwining here are just that. It's not the seed of the serpent, seed of the woman. It's the growth of nations.
That's right. And then it did come through. Remember God telling Abraham, nations are going to mm-hmm. come out of you.
Mm-hmm.
So here's a big chunk of that fulfillment already. Right, kings are going to come out of you. Nations are going to come out of you. That's right. It's not just Israel that's descended from Abraham, although Israel's the dominant line.
Mm-hmm.
They're the spiritual blessing. You know, they're the big force, ultimately. So those are the two big points. You know, the first one is spiritual growth is a slow, steady process. Secular growth often outpaces it. Which you cannot really mix those two. It's not wise to bring secular growth principles into the church. There's a million applications of that. A million. You know, churches do gimmicky things all the time, you know, to grab members and so on. And it's not, I would say that is not spiritually wise. I understand the rationale that would come forth in defense of it. It's not spiritually wise. You don't have biblical examples of that. You have modern-day marketing examples of that, but no biblical examples.
So like the health and wealth guys you see on TV kind of deal?
I would say, in a strange way, this chapter is a great chapter to refer to push that, get about as far away from you as you can get. There's nothing at the end of that road. Spiritual growth is a long, long, hard process.
Yeah, you can't buy a closer relationship with God with money, correct?
Oh, that's right. So you want to do anything more in that chapter, or you want to go forward to the next one?
I keep moving on.
Okay. Yeah, let's
read. The only other question I had there, Bob, real quick before we move on. I don't understand the Chiefs, because it's basically the same kids that were just named and a couple of other people. Who are the Chiefs? What are they, a king? Why are they
identified? It's not quite a king, or they just said king, because mm-hmm. they have that word, king, and he uses it of certain people and not of others. But a chief, you know, it'd almost be the equivalent of, I suppose, I'm fishing around a little bit here for how to explain that, but it's closer to, just as in Israel exists as 12 tribes. So the elders in those tribes are not kings of Israel, but they're very powerful people. You could, in a sense, call them chiefs.
Gotcha.
They're not kings.
Gotcha. But leaders, nonetheless.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Of sizable groups. But they're not a king with a defined territory and, you know, the weight of government on their shoulders and so on. But they carry a ton of influence.
So now the illustration explanation that you just gave even is clearer to me. Now I see what Moses is saying. This is a strong group.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Gotcha.
Very much so. So here's Genesis chapter 37, which marks a distinct... here we go. These last 13 chapters, you know, all hang together. They fill out the rest of the book of Genesis, and they're really the story of Joseph. You know, it'll be labeled like, as you see in verse 1, now Jacob lived in the land. It looks like the records of the generations of Jacob, it says in verse 2. But actually, which is true enough, but really it's going to all revolve around Joseph. So let's read this chapter. Now, Jacob lived in the land. By the way, you can almost see, you know, Moses, okay, I'm done with Esau for now.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm going to this other part of this story.
Right.
Now Jacob lived in the land where his father had sojourned, in the land of Canaan. These are the records of the generations of Jacob. Joseph, when 17 years of age, was pasturing the flock with his brothers while he was still a youth, along with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought back a bad report about them to their father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his sons, because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a very colored tunic. His brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, and they hated him and could not speak to him on friendly terms. Then Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. He said to them, "Please listen to this dream which I have had. For behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheaf rose up and also stood erect, and behold, your sheaves gathered around and bowed down to my sheaf." Then his brothers said to him, "Are you actually going to reign over us? Or are you really going to rule over us?" So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. Now he had still another dream, and related it to his brothers, and said, "Lo, I've had still another dream. Behold, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars were bowing down to me." And he related it to his father and to his brothers, and his father rebuked him and said to him, "What is this dream that you've had? Shall I and your mother and your brothers actually come to bow ourselves down before you to the ground?" His brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the saying in mind. Then his brothers went to pasture their father's flock in Shechem. Israel said to Joseph, "Are not your brothers pasturing the flock in Shechem? Come, and I'll send you to them." And he said to him, "I will go." Then he said to him, "Go now and see about the welfare of your brothers and the welfare of the flock. Bring word back to me." And he went and sent. And he sent him from the valley of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. A man found him, and behold, he was wandering in the field. And the man asked, "What are you looking for?" And he said, "I'm looking for my brothers. Please tell me where they're pasturing the flock." Then the man said, "They've moved from here, for I heard them say, 'Let us go to Dothan.' So Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. When they saw him from a distance, and before he came close to them, they plotted against him to put him to death. They said to one another, "Here comes that this dreamer. Now then, come and let us kill him. Throw him into one of the pits, and we will say, 'A wild beast devoured him.' Then let us see what will become of his dreams." But Reuben heard this. He rescued him out of their hands and said, "Let us not take his life." Reuben further said to them, "Shed no blood. Throw him into this pit that's in the wilderness, but do not lay hands on him, that he might rescue him out of their hands to restore him to his father." So it came about, when Joseph reached his brothers, that they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the very colored tunic that was on him. They took him and threw him into the pit. Now the pit was empty, without any water in it. Then they sat down to eat a meal. And as they raised their eyes and looked, behold, a caravan of Ishmaelites was coming from Gilead, with their camels bearing aromatic gum and balm and myrrh, on their way to bring them down to Egypt. Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is it for us to kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come and let us sell to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him. For he's our brother, our own flesh." His brothers listened to him. Then some Midianite traders passed by, so they pulled him up and lifted Joseph out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. Thus they brought Joseph into Egypt. Now Reuben returned to the pit, and behold, Joseph was not in the pit. So he tore his garments, and he returned to his brothers and said, "The boy's not there. As for me, where am I to go?" So they took Joseph's tunic and slaughtered a male goat, and dipped the tunic in the blood. And they sent the very colored tunic and brought it to their father and said, "We found this. Please examine it to see whether it's your son's tunic or not." Then he examined it and said, "It is my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces." So Jacob tore his clothes and put sackcloth on his loins and mourned for his son many days. Then all his sons and all his daughters arose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. And he said, "Surely I will go down to Sheol in mourning for my son." So his father wept for him. Meanwhile, the Midianites sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, Pharaoh's officer, the captain of the bodyguard.
Well, here goes that jealousy rearing its ugly head again. You know, this chapter kind of made me think of Cain, the story of Cain and Abel again.
Oh, absolutely. That's a very good observation, and it's accurate. You know, before we even get into the details of the text as best we can, very much there's a picture throughout the scriptures that you do not see the devil up front very often. But you see, since his handiwork in chapter 3, mankind doesn't need a lot of help.
No.
You know, these feelings, you know, this unchecked jealousy that turns into hatred, enough to murder your brother and cover it up and lie about it, is the work of the devil. Mankind, apart from God, is demonic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. And hence the cosmic battle that we're always talking about. And you look at, what was I just going to say, Bob? Let me hope I did not lose my train of thought. I think I did. It'll come back to me. But very much you see how, or I see how, you know, and God protects this seed almost by, you know, it seems like by taking Joseph out of that situation totally.
Yeah.
You know, he protects that line.
He definitely is protecting the seed. No question. And he's using, you know, Reuben steps in, tries to do that. Judah steps in, mm-hmm. and facilitates in that. And these are not the way Moses is painting the picture right now. You know, the best of guys, but God's using them to protect that seed. The other guys would have killed him.
Yeah.
Apparently.
It sounded like immediately that's all they wanted to do.
And it looks like, you know, sometimes you wonder about the story, you know, your head sort of tilts, you're like, now what? Because you're piecing it together. Apparently, Reuben has left, right? Like, don't mm-hmm. kill him, just, right. you know, we'll just throw him in the pit for now, but don't kill him. And then apparently he leaves, because he comes back and looks in the pit, and he's not there. He doesn't know he's been sold into slavery yet. So that's what's going on in, like, you know, those verses around 28 and following.
It makes you also...
Well, 29.
Why did Joseph even tell him about that dream?
Yeah, there wasn't a lot of... Well, that raises this issue, because you see this idea developed more... in the coming chapters, this is going to happen with Joseph down in Egypt, you know, these dreams that Pharaoh's going to have. But as a 21st century now reader in Western culture, we don't give a whole lot of credence to dreams.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they might shake us emotionally, but we don't go around telling people, hey, here's what God told me in a dream kind of thing. Not even many Christians do that, you know, that's strange, but in the ancient Near East, that was a very accepted way for God to reveal things to people. We've seen it once or twice already in Genesis, right? Mm-hmm. Abimelech would have a dream, you know, God would speak to him in the dream and so on, and that's going to happen with Pharaoh as well. So the fact that Joseph's having these dreams, he's excited about God's revelation. I think he's naively excited about it, like sharing it with his brothers just because he's excited. He doesn't realize how they're going to hear that.
Thinking they might be excited with it.
Yeah, you know, like, oh, cool, God's talking to me. And they're like, we're going to bow down to you?
Right.
And you know what? They are going to. Well, just like God said. But, you know, that's to be revealed here in time.
And Dad, he hears it, and he's like,
Yeah, you note his response. It's a very similar thing said about Mary in the New Testament, when the shepherds would say things, and that mm-hmm. they'd say, hey, these angels appeared to us and said, man, this is the Messiah, and says she treasured these things in her heart. You know, it's they take it as God's revelation. Mm-hmm. You know, they're puzzled about it and so on, but they grab onto it.
Yeah,
The brothers don't want anything to do with it.
Period.
Yeah, they reject it.
And their solution is
killing.
And it really, I mean, how many times have we just seen that now? And maybe, you know, this isn't such a big revelation, but I've seen jealousy, you know, and deceit just wrecking balls.
That's right. Two of the biggest tools of the devil, those two things, jealousy and deceit. Deceit's number one. By far.
Mm-hmm.
And jealousy gets a lot of airtime in the scriptures. Because it's the opposite of the Lord's attitude. The Lord's a definition of humble.
Right. Right.
So, by the way, as far as, you know, applying those, if you take time out from your days and weeks and your life and your family and so on and examine your own heart, it's a very healthy thing to do. And if you see jealousy, and if you see hatred and jealousy, bitterness,
envy,
you have to find a way to get rid of that, because it will eat you alive. It's exactly like that, and it'll produce the works of the devil. It will not produce the works of God.
Gotcha. Because I have seen that, and in reading this chapter, I started thinking about it. I'm like, wow, it's, you know, Moses is really making a point of giving me and us examples of, you know, what comes out of jealousy and what comes out of envy and what comes out of deceit.
And death and destruction. I mean, it's terrible stuff.
Yeah.
That's right. One other thing I wanted to mention in particular, and that is that, Joseph has two dreams, right? Mm-hmm. First, it's the sheaves of grain, you know, yours were bowing down to me. Second, hey, the sun and the moon, the stars were bowing down to me. Okay, so, but it's the same point
mm-hmm.
with both dreams, but he has it twice. And that's going to be important later on in the story, because Pharaoh's going to have two dreams. And Joseph's going to say the reason you're having two of these same things is because it's soon and certain. That's what the repetition means. Soon and certain. It's from God, and it's soon and certain. Single dream doesn't cut it. Got to do it twice.
Gotcha. Should we move into 38?
Yeah, let's do one more chapter because this sort of flows together. And it doesn't, at first reading, it doesn't flow together. So I'm going to ask you a quick, you're going to have, this is going to be another test of your reading skills. All right? So be prepared. Genesis 38. It came about at that time that Judah departed from his brothers and visited a certain Adullamite, whose name was Hira. And Judah saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite, whose name was Shua. And he took her and went into her. So she conceived and bore a son, and he named him Ur. Then she conceived again and bore a son, and he named him Onan. She bore still another son and named him Shelah. And it was at Kezib that she bore him. Now Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Ur, Judah's firstborn, was evil in the sight of the Lord. So the Lord took his life. Then Judah said to Onan, "Go into your brother's wife and perform your duty as a brother-in-law to her. Raise up offspring for your brother." Onan knew that the offspring would not be his. So when he went into his brother's wife, he wasted his seed on the ground in order not to give offspring to his brother. But what he did was displeasing in the sight of the Lord, so he took his life also. Then Judah said to his daughter-in-law Tamar, "Remain a widow in your father's house till my son Shelah grows up." For he thought, "I'm afraid that he too may die like his brothers." So Tamar went and lived in her father's house. Now after a considerable time, Shua's daughter, the wife of Judah, died. And when the time of mourning was ended, Judah went up to his sheep shearers at Timnah, he and his friend Hira the Adullamite. It was told Tamar, "Behold, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep." So she removed her widow's garments, covered herself with a veil, wrapped herself, and sat in the gateway of Enaim, which is on the road to Timnah. For she saw that Shelah had grown up, and she had not been given to him as a wife. When Judah saw her, he thought she was a harlot, for she had covered her face. So he turned aside to her by the road and said, "Here now, let me come in to you." For he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. And she said, "What will you give me, that you may come in to me?" And he said, "Therefore, I'll send you a young goat from the flock." And she said, "Moreover, will you give a pledge till you send it?" And he said, "What pledge shall I give you?" She said, "Your seal and your cord and your staff that's in your hand." So he gave them to her and went into her, and she conceived by him. Then she arose and departed, removed her veil, put on her widow's garments. When Judah sent the young goat by his friend the Adullamite to receive the pledge from the woman's hand, he did not find her. And he asked the men of her place, saying, "Where's the temple prostitute who was by the road at Enaim?" But they said, "There's been no temple prostitute here." So he returned to Judah and said, "I didn't find her." Furthermore, the men of the place said, "There's been no temple prostitute here." Then Judah said, "Let her keep them. Otherwise, we'll become a laughingstock. After all, I sent this young goat, but you did not find her." Now, it was about 3 months later that Judah was informed, "Your daughter-in-law Tamar has played the harlot. And behold, she's also a child by harlotry." Then Judah said, "Bring her out. Let her be burned." It was while she was being brought out that she sent to her father-in-law, saying, "I am with child by the man to whom these things belong." And she said, "Please examine and see. Whose signet ring and cords and staff are these?" And Judah recognized them and said, "She's more righteous than I, inasmuch as I did not give her to my son Shelah." And he did not have relations with her again. It came about at the time she was giving birth that, behold, there were twins in her womb. Moreover, it took place while she was giving birth. One put out a hand. The midwife took and tied a scarlet thread on his hand, saying, this one came out first. But it came about as he drew back his hand that, behold, his brother came out. Then she said, what a breach you have made for yourself. So he was named Perez. Afterward, his brother came out, who had the scarlet thread on his hand, and he was named Zerah. All right, champ, what's going on?
All kinds of stuff.
I thought this was all about Joseph. He's not even in there.
What did happen?
He's down in Egypt doing his thing. But no mention of him here. And yet we're in the Joseph story, but there's no mention of Joseph here.
Is it, again, to get back to the seed, you know, that's going to come through Judah,
there is,
ultimately?
Yeah, there is, well, it even says seed in there, uses the word, right? When the one guy spills his seed and won't, yeah, and that, God's not happy with that.
Right.
You know, so it seems like the overall thrust of the chapter is there's a wanton disregard for the seed.
Yeah.
And here's Judah, like, what are you doing? He's taking a wife from the Canaanites, right? Not like his forefathers did, not like his father and his grandfather and his great-grandfather. So he just, it almost gives a casual appearance, you know? Sees a woman, so, okay, here we go. And then his children marry Canaanite. You know, it's all Canaanite. And the seeds being wasted, and yet, when you turn to the Gospel of Matthew, Perez and Zerah are in there. This is part of the tribe of Judah. So when you think, by the way, of Israel, Israel's really an amalgamation, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's Canaanites in Israel.
Now,
they're in the line of the Messiah.
How's that work?
I think God's always been all about all of mankind, not just one group. And it's the broadening of his grace.
So is it...
they're in the line of
like
the Messiah.
Boaz and
Jesus
that?
Comes through these guys.
Through these two in particular,
yes.
Right?
Zerah and Perez.
Yeah.
Tamar is in the line of the Messiah, comes from these guys.
Because does it go through Boaz and Ruth? Is that where...
It goes through there as well, yeah.
That's where this vine is going to...
Mm-hmm.
Interesting, because that was one of the things I was wondering is, you know, what ultimately happens to Perez and Tamar?
Yeah, they end up in the line of the Messiah. Now, it seems like, you know, a lot of the chapter has to do with, you know, Tamar and her trying to get pregnant and so on. Judah's afraid to give another son to her because the first two have died. He thinks there's something wrong with her.
Right.
Like she's cursed somehow. When he's about as low as you get, I mean, the reason he went into her is he thought she was a prostitute. You know? A temple prostitute, by the way, you know?
And what is
foreign
that?
Foreign idols? He's involved in idolatry? It's just bizarre. It's bizarre.
It almost needs, this chapter almost needs to have a rating.
Yeah, it does. And it's also would remind, should have, by the way, this is part of Matthew's point in referring to this in his gospel, should have reminded the Jews never really to get too proud. Look, you guys got a pretty sordid history here. There's a bunch of fratricide, attempted fratricide. You're trying to kill Joseph.
Mm-hmm.
Judah, your big hero, looks about as slimy as you get, other than at the end he steps up. Oh, she's more righteous than I am. You know,
What does that mean? She's more righteous than I, because...
Well, he recognized her. She actually is trying to preserve the seed, right? It was his responsibility to give his third son to her. and he didn't do it. Remember, he says, like, man, I could kill my third son, too. I'm not doing that. But that is what was required in that situation. So he's not doing it. So when he grows up and he's old enough and Tamar's looking around and Judah's not giving him to her, she knows he's not gonna. So, all right, I'll take matters into my own hand, you know, since you're not doing it. That's his confession. She's more righteous than I am. She's actually doing the right thing since I barred her from the legal way to do this.
And as you pointed out, you know, it'd be very easy, you know, to manipulate words and really pretty this up. But this is one of the few accounts of history, human history, that actually accounts for everything, the wins, the losses, the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Yeah, God will tell you the truth.
Right.
You know, there's no need to belabor it. You know, did this happen countless times? Probably. He's not going to tell you every time, but he is going to let you know, even in my own people, yeah, there's a bunch of bad stuff here. The fact that it was he thought she was a temple prostitute.
Now, what's
well, there's
the
worship involved in that. You know, dude, that's worship of idols, kind of involved with sexual stuff. I mean, it's bad. But that's how they saw. It's in on one sense not as bad as today's kind of stuff, even though it sounds worse. But it's there. You can see how these ancient cultures were. The thought of reproduction predominated with them. Mm-hmm. That's what they need. Their wealth was gauged by how many children you have, not what job. They're all shepherds and stuff like that. So, you know, job achievement isn't a lot for them.
And
that's
why
not
they
a
had
status
so many
thing. It's children, and that's why Abraham it was so awkward. He's this great chief kind of guy, and he's got no kids. You know, it's really awkward until he begins to have children. But so. Their worship of deities often revolved around that sort of practice because that's what they wanted from God. Today, we want to win the lottery. Okay, back then they wanted children.
They wanted the family line there.
That's right.
But it's still, I mean, it's as weird as all get out, you know, as we talk about a lot of things I don't get in that culture. It just doesn't.
Yeah, even the fact that, see, what they're dealing with, the cultural norm, is, say, Kathy and I, we're married. We'll say I died before we had any children. Were we living back in these days, the cultural norm would be for my older brother to take Kathy and have children with her in my name. So establishing my family for me. That's what's going on with. That's why she's marrying these brothers. That was their responsibility. And you see that later on. That gets written into the laws of Israel. It's your Levirate marriage. You're supposed to do that. So here's. So when Moses is writing the laws in Leviticus, in Exodus, and in Deuteronomy, some of those are already in existence. Okay, so. That's a cultural thing, which, you know, we don't have today. That's strange, but to them, that was the way they did it.
So, why the story of Judah in the middle of Joseph's story? I don't think I got wood on that.
Right, here comes the pitch.
Okay.
Now, what kind of literature are we in? How would you describe the genre of Genesis?
Like story?
Yeah, and the technical word for that is narrative, okay? Mm-hmm. But it's story, that's right. Now, one of the tools, in fact, a pretty common and powerful tool in narrative literatures, repetition. So, did you notice any repetition between chapter 37 and 38? Now, let me give you a hint before you... See, don't pick it up now, and you're going to look. But let me give you a hint. What did the brothers say to Jacob when they handed him the coat that they had put blood on?
this is your
That's
sense.
That's exactly code. Right. Please examine to see. Mm-hmm. What did Tamar say to Judah when they go, hey, your daughter-in-law's pregnant by harlotry, and he says she should be burned?
Mm-hmm.
What'd she say?
Whoever owns these.
But word for word, please examine and see. Now look at it in your Bible. Look at verse 38:25. It was while she was being brought out that she sent to her father. They're bringing her out to burn her, right? While she was being brought out, that she sent to her father-in-law, saying, I am with child by the man to whom these belong. And she said, please examine and see whose signet ring and cords and staff are these. Now, do you think when she says that to him, this echo goes off in his mind? That's exactly what I said to my dad. And I was deceiving him. She's actually telling the truth. But it's the same phrase. Now, that's what's going on the human level. What do you think God is saying? Do you think God is saying to his people, which in our day and right now is you and me, a bunch of other people, but you and me right here, is he saying, please examine and see, my will be done regardless of what you guys try to do? Right? They had said to Joseph, oh really, are you going to rule over us? Yes, he is.
Even
if you try and kill him, and he's not going to rule over you for his glory. It's because God has chosen him at this point in history to deliver Egypt and Israel and the whole world from famine. God chose him. Okay, you, no matter what you do, you're not going to get out of God's express will. So I think that phrase, please examine and see, is the key to the entire Joseph story. The whole thing, all 13 chapters revolve around that. It all works out just like God said, even through these bizarre circumstances all the way through. And I think Moses is challenging the people of God to be discerning. I mean, please examine and see. How often do we walk through our days spiritually dull, you know, not examining to see. We're examining to see if things work out in our favor,
right?
You know, we're not examining to see God's will being accomplished through no matter what is going on. I think this is just a gigantic chapter. I think that's why chapter 38 is in there. That's because it looks like it's not about Joseph on the surface, and I think it's all about him.
Mm-hmm.
In examination.
And in a sense, Bob, you know, it made me think as you were talking about that. How many times, you know, in my own life, and I, you know, as I run into other people and, you know, talking about the Word, and they say, "Oh, I know the Bible."
I get the Bible. I've heard that. Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it means that. And there is no examination that has taken place there.
That's right.
At all.
That's right.
Huh.
You're exactly right. And I think that's the punch in the face from this chapter. You know, to Judah, please examine and see. You're going to burn this woman while you were part of selling your brother into slavery in hopes of really getting rid of him.
Mm-hmm.
You lied to your father about the death of his son. You know, you you fake the death of his favorite son? I mean, imagine the torment Jacob's going through. Mm-hmm. And I sent my kid and he got killed. You know, Jacob's in deep mourning. And here's Judah, you know, watching him every day. Yeah, oh, sorry, Dad. Really, you caused the whole thing? You're lying about it? And I mean, so here's God, you know, getting right in his face. Please examine and see what's going on. I just think that's a huge principle in our lives, that we need to spiritually pause and examine and see what's really going on. Have some depth of insight.
Examine the truth. I mean,
examine the truth. Please, because examine and see.
The truth, it doesn't matter what angle you look at it. It's still the same thing.
That's right.
It doesn't change. It doesn't change shape. It doesn't change
form. Or maybe, let's clarify that, because this is an important thought. Truth is solitary. It's singular. In that we define it as truth is that which corresponds to reality. But there may be manifold, 10, dozen, hundreds of applications of the truth. Mm-hmm. But there's truth by its nature is exclusive. It's a solitary thing.
Right. Right. So. Well, my friend, should we wrap up this episode?
We should. We've covered 3 chapters.
And not bad. It looks like we're at an hour in.
1 hour, 3 chapters. That's great, with a lot of pronunciation of hard names and stuff. But let's keep our listeners excited. So we're in chapter 38. We've covered that. So there's only 12 more chapters to go. And when we get done with Genesis, then we'll also have written material. We'll probably create a website by that time. And then we'll have written material so you can read the word in the quiet of your own room and home, and then you can hear us talk about it, and then you can have notes for it in front of you as well, the visual. So we're trying to cover every base.
It's a good way to sit down for that meal.
That's how we eat the meal. That's how we learn to examine and see.
One bite at a time.
All right, let's pray. Lord, we confess our own shortcomings and our failure to pause and examine and see. And we lament that we often just run through our days and think that we're seeing, when in reality our perceptions are no better than those of infants. But you've called us to maturity, and it takes a long time of faithful steps, constantly eating the meal of your words. So we pray that we would be about the business of spiritual growth and spiritual discernment. In Jesus' name, amen.